Hi, this is Tuesday night from A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and you are listening to Rants from the Black Lodge Podcast.
Reporting live from the Black Lodge, it's me, the free will burning head turning ass kicking machismo dripping master podcast and mouthpiece of the Southeast, Brandon A. Lane, bringing you a new edition of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, but no one is sweeter than the lady you heard at the top of this podcast, star of A Nightmare on Elm Street 4. The lovely and very talented Tuesday night. Now, by this point, I am assuming that Tuesday is probably tired of me messaging her, hounding her for this intro, but I can't thank her enough. She took time out of her busy schedule to be kind enough to do this for us, so the least I can do for her is give her a shout-out. So I invite all of our listeners out there in the Rant Army to go and check her out on social media. You can find her on Twitter, at NightTues. I'm going to spell that out just so there's no confusion. K-N-I-G-H-T-T-U-E-S. That's simple enough. Also find her at TuesdayNight.com. We're inducting you as an honorary member of the Rant Army. But you're not the only one. So in addition to a full-length running commentary track for A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, we actually had an opportunity to sit down with the man who I now consider to be the actual Dream Master, working behind the scenes to bring all those nightmares to your memories, iconic production designer Mick Strawn. Mick and I have become a bit of friends. And so, Mick, I want to give a shout out to you for being nice enough to do this podcast by shedding a little light on his podcast. It's called Dream Warrior Review. They do film discussions. They're nice, short, to the point episodes, 20, 30 minutes. They're perfect for me. I can pop them in and listen to them on my way to work. And I have done that constantly ever since discovering it. So you can find them on Podbean, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, basically all the places this podcast is available, which, of course, is iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, of course, at our homepage at juicykruger.com, and don't forget to follow us at Rants Black Lodge. Well, let's get some messages from our sponsors, and when we return, we'll be having a nice long discussion with our new friend, Mick Strawn. Stay tuned, everybody.
Next Generation Wrestling brings some of the most talked about and star-studded professional wrestlers from around the world. Based out of East Tennessee, NGW is becoming one of the most sought-after independent wrestling promotions in the past 4 years. Witness NGW Live or on demand on the High Spots Wrestling Network streaming app. Follow us on social media platforms at NextGenTN.
All right, Rant Army, making his debut into the Black Lodge, we have a man whose body of work includes such films as Candyman, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, Blade, and of course the film we are spotlighting here tonight, A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I give you the man, the myth, the legend, all rolled into one, Mr. Mick Strawn. Thank you so much, Mick, for taking time out of your busy schedule to visit us here with the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast.
Well, there you go. Here, you know, no matter where you go, there you are.
Well, right out of the gate, and I don't mean this in any sort of a demeaning way, but what the hell does a production designer do?
I don't know, but you know what?
Everybody seems to know what a director does and an editor does, and it seems that production design is sort of the redheaded stepchild as far as what people recognize film duties. So if you want to explain what you do.
You know, it's got a lot of different meanings, because depending on the film, a production designer kind of does different things. But the production designer is involved primarily in the overall look of a film. And I don't know how to describe that to you other than me personally. I design the sets. I mean, that's the most common thing that you could equate it with is an art director style. In other words, you you design the sets, but a production designer kind of goes over that in that, you know, his purview is almost anything that he wants on a film, or not that he wants, but what a film needs. It's just the look of it. I mean, I can get involved in, have gotten involved on films in making the sets, getting an eye for the costumes, and making sure everything comes into a cohesive look, and then protecting that look through the length of the film. In other words, I would have discussions with the director as the film goes along, because it's my job to make sure that the film looks like what my job was, to look like what I wanted all the way along, and to defend that against the vicissitudes of filmmaking.
So you're sort of like, you're the one who is keeping the theme from a visual standpoint. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. Let me give you an example, because Nightmare on Elm Street 4 is the perfect example of it. Nightmare on Elm Street 4 had, and some of these sets were like on locations and were built and manipulated, and all that manipulation is mine. The thing is everything that you see is not accidental. I mean, it's not like it just happens. It's like it's intentional all the way down the line. If you were considering, say, we want to make the Elm Street house look, then it's my job to give you an idea and then make sure the exterior location looks like the interior of it. Once to make sure that these have all come together. And I'll give you an example in Nightmare on Elm Street 4. The location wasn't, because we wanted a completely exaggerated Nightmare on Elm Street house, and we couldn't do it at the original location, so we built the Elm Street house again, the exterior as well as the interior.
That's incredible. Now, when you're in that position of having to recreate something from a previous movie, how do you go about that? Like, as far as, you have like the specs that were used before, do you have to like just kind of wing it from just watching the film and making those comparisons? How do you go about that?
Well, I think winging it is a, you know, you're not winging it as much as you're reinventing it.
Okay.
And the thing is on the nightmares, everybody, every director, every production designer, and so forth, were all hired to give it a new look each time, right? A look that goes with that particular set of visions for it. We can even go to the effects of it. I mean, I was really involved with effects because I worked in designing effects as well as worked in designing sets. What I wanted, we wanted to go really big. Like, Nightmare on Elm Street wasn't a subtlety.
No, absolutely not.
I can certainly give you, I can give you a great story as to, now, because I production designed 3 also, and then moved to Nightmare on Elm Street 4. I give you an example of what a production designer does that you don't know about.
Oh, please do.
I designed the junkyard, okay?
Oh, love it.
And what we did is we literally went in and we bought all the cars in a junkyard. And I built a model that had 290-something cars in the model. And we bought cars and then cleared a lot that was owned by the same junkyard next door. And we cleared that lot and then placed all the cars in it. If you get my book, you can behind the screens, you can see some of the pictures of the junkyard and the placing of the cars that went along, because it was an incredible piece of work. You know, it took 6 weeks, and it took 20 to 25 people that were in the art department, and then another 10 people that were, you know, working in special effects. To do all the gags that were in it, because all that was practical except for one element, and that's therein lies the story. There's one element that was shot as the beginning of an optical, a model, And then we built to the model at the same time that the optical effects people built to that same model. For the shot of Kincaid circling and saying, Freddy, and yelling, Freddy's back, right? What we did is we did a pull-up and then was in the maze that we had created in real life. And then became a model that was made off of my model, right? So that the placement was correct, so that so that you didn't see where you melded from reality into the optical. At the end of our shooting, at the end of that, we gave them our negative, and then we gave it to DreamWorks, and DreamWorks then took it, spent 2 weeks shooting the model that they had shot, and gave it back to us, and then showed it to us. If you look really closely at the show itself, you'll see that there's actually a rectangle around that you see in the show as it's pulling back. In that shot, as it's pulling back, a really highly detailed part of it that looks like a rectangle. And that was what they brought back to us and said, okay, well, this is the shot. And I said, well, wait a minute. That's not the shot, because the shot is supposed to be the world. And they said, well, you know, that represents the world there, that shot. And I go, no. There are still corners to this, and we're going to pull out. We're pulling out, and we're going to see the world. You understand that we're making this an auto world, and we had storyboard with Pete Von Schaly. See, this is what we're looking at. This is, it's a world, okay? But we're out of money, outrageously over budget. Tell you what, I'll just give you $15,000 more. Because they didn't want to be over budget. I said, well, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
As long as I am already. Now, I was over budget 3 weeks before we even started filming. I was over budget.
I can imagine. I mean, all the money is definitely on screen.
Well, and you know, the problem that we had with the show, or not the problem, but kind of part of the reason it came out the way that it did, was because I would sit there and say, okay, well, then write something different. If you don't want it to look like this, because that's my concept of it, then you write it so it doesn't have to. And nobody wanted to argue with me, so I just kept spending money. So I give them $15,000, and they take it, and they go, okay.
You're a man of many persuasions.
Right. Hey, believe me. Trust me. I mean, you know, production design is only 5%, you know, concept and art, and it's 95% just pure bullshit to get from point A to point B. And you remember when I was talking about saying, well, you know, part of my job is to defend the design as you go along. You have no idea how important that becomes as things go on. Now I even get the square to irritate the hell out of me. I can see that rectangle. So what they did is they came out and went beyond the rectangle. Now it went out a little bit further. You see, back then, if you'd already shot something, man, that was locked in. If it was an optical, that was locked in. And you were stuck with that, and you just kept going on the same piece of film. So now they come back, and now what they have is an interactive mat. An interactive mat is a painting that has lights in it. Right. Well, in this case, that was the interactive. Was some of the lights were blinking, right? And some of the model lights blinked, and now the interactive had little lights in it, and it went out to another rectangle. I was, guys, where's my world here? And then, the big argument came up, and they said, okay, we're going to have Phil explain this to you, or whoever it was. And physically, if we were moving away from the Earth at a given, and you came back, you know, it would take about 25 minutes to get from the point to where you looking at Earth and you could see the edges of it. And said, wait a minute, hold on. I cannot believe. Now, and this is a case of where intelligence, or it's something like intelligence, I guess, kind of gets the best of you, and you start to overthink it to the point to where you're just plain wrong, and it just, it would take you 20 minutes to get to the point to be the size of Earth. You see what I'm saying here?
I know what you're saying.
I'm in the middle of a film about dreams, and you're telling me that you can't just stop at some point and make it fucking round? Are you? See, you didn't want to ask if somebody was high back then, because the chances were they were.
They're giving ammunition to the flat earthers.
Yeah, you didn't want to get an argument. What are you, high or something? They turn around and go, what are you, not? That's kind of an intrinsic problem at the time. If you see what I'm saying.
Oh, Lord.
So I said, look, I'll give you $15,000. No, I'm not fucking kidding. When you come back, it better look like a motherfucking planet. And the really weird thing about it is that if you look at the shot, you understand that they went from a meticulously detailed model to an interactive matte optical version of using crayons to finish the thing out.
How often on set does these sort of butting of heads moments come up?
It just depends on the group, but you have to understand that we're all ego-driven, and different films have different amounts of it. Basically, on that film, part of the reason I wrote the book that I did was because on that film I had that magical feeling that there were great bulk of people in that film were going in the same direction and doing things that you have to look at all the people that went on to do amazing things from that show. You know,
well, Rennie, obviously.
Well, yeah, but Rennie and Chris Biggs and the DP's second and third unit went on to be, Oscar winners. The list goes on and on and on and on. I had worked in a lot of TV, and I had worked on Tales from the Dark Side. And on Tales from the Dark Side, it seemed like every other script came up with the word limbo. Right? Mysterious limbo, right? You go, yeah, oh yeah, oh, it's another limbo, you know? So you did everything creative in limbos that you could. And I think limbo is designated as any set that starts with a bunch of black fabric. So you can't tell where you are. That's limbo. And then you go from there. And I had kind of really learned what the camera could see and what it couldn't. And we were completely out of money, and we were getting to the end of the script. We rented the warehouse next door, or I think it was maybe two warehouses down. We rented another warehouse, and we walked in there and said, okay, well, this is where we're going to put the Friday church. And I went, yeah. Now, you have to understand, if I was over budget 3 weeks before we started filming, imagine where I was by that point.
Deep in the hole.
Nobody wanted to see me. When I saw the accountants, all they did was roll their fucking eyes. That was it. You know, just, shit, that guy. Okay, so I said, you know what we're going to do is we're going to ring in this place with black fabric. And then we'll just put the most important prop pieces in, and we're going to fill it with smoke, and we're going to call it the Freddy Church. And that's exactly what it was, because that entire set consisted of frames of windows hanging in the air, and they weren't even windows. They were just, literally the frames of windows to give you this look that there's a window, right? And then there was a big flat that was 14 feet high that had the double doors in it, the weird trapezoidal doors. We created a stone rim around that. And we had some platforms, some pews, a couple of columns, and stained glass window at the front of it that was a match to the one that CJ had built that was at the end of the tunnel, what I call the kaleidoscope set.
To watch this right now, and you had not told me that, I would not have. I would have thought if everything was put together in black fabric. So that's the pretty magic of filmmaking. So that's just proof of the pudding and how good you are at your job.
Well, here's the funny thing about it is that when you were standing there in that set, quote unquote set, it was sort of like people kept looking around going, so this is it? And I go, dude, trust me on this. The camera is going to build this thing. And the thing is I remember distinctly thinking to myself that I was like the huckster from 76 Trombones, that just that the camera's going to do it. You know, if you keep thinking, right, if you keep thinking about the note, you'll create that note. And I have to tell you, it worked, and I love this. Every once in a while, I said, so what was the Freddie Church made of? I tell people that. What was on the walls?
Well, that's truly incredible, and I'm glad you shared that story here, because I'm sure our listeners will be, when they watch the film along with us later on in this very episode, to point that out. So thanks for that. I did plenty of research on this, and I did not know that. Your work, at least from my perspective now, since you told us that excellent story about, you know, the building of the church and how black fabric saved the production single-handedly. You have this book out called Behind the Screams. You want to tell us a little bit about where people, number one, where they can get it, why they should get it, and go.
Okay, well, you know, you go to behindthescreamsbook.com and you can order it. You basically order it from me and I send it out of my house. I have enough copies to sell at conventions, because I go to a lot of conventions. And that's the reason to buy it is this, is I got together with Blake Best, and we interviewed maybe 40 to 50 people that worked on the film that were friends of mine. And then that way I could take – originally it was going to be my story about the making of the film. But I kept having to call people up to fill in, because I wanted a more complete story of it than you hear, because you always hear the stars and the director and the basically that, the stars and the director, you know.
The principal people, yeah.
Right, right. And they tell the same damn stories all the time. And the thing is the making of these things was a tremendous story. I mean, making of anything has got, you know, so many better stories, and they're so much more indicative of the time. And what we didn't know at the time was that it was about the last that you were going to get building really, really big things and doing every possible type of makeup and mechanical effects that exists, you know, in a show, because pretty much over the 90s began to come of age, and mid-2000s, the concept of doing things this way was completely gone, you know.
It's really sad that, like, all these, the old-school mentality, which I think a lot of, well, I think I would say that just horror movies and just movies in general are sorely lacking in that attention to detail. Like you were saying, like, nothing on set is by accident. Well, having an actual effect on screen, you know, that's somebody actually built with their hands, is just a completely different experience.
It's pretty intentional.
Yeah, it's very intentional. But it's just a different experience than seeing something that somebody is, I mean, don't get me wrong, they've spent hours working hard on a computer, but these films hold up because of the blood, the sweat, and the tears that went into making them, and like I said before,
the
money's on screen, the ingenuity's there too.
This is why I want people to get this book, is I tried to tell all those stories. I tried all that background stories, all the stories about what it was like to make this stuff work, to work on this bizarre scale that just isn't going to happen again. You know, it was blood, sweat, and tears. I mean, there's just so many examples of it, and there's so many examples of, you know, how the hard work actually came out on the screen. And I I think that my book is completely unique in that it goes in, it looks at everybody's different, all the different stories that were behind the book.
I will say that for anybody that has any interest in the behind the scenes making of films, this is definitely a book they need to be checking out. I myself am going to be getting a copy here in the next little bit. Tax times are right around the corner. So I'll be putting some dollar bills in your pocket very soon, Mr. Strong.
There you go. You know, I spent a lot of money on making it look the way that I wanted, and I will never make back the money that I put into it. So, you know, I guess it's going to be a labor of love.
All right, Freddy isn't the only slasher you've had history with, and you also worked on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, which, from what I've learned about production design today, only makes me appreciate that film even more because it's beautiful, all the bone art and all that stuff, very cool. But the new thing that you've got going on is you're actually working on a film called Vengeance, which is a 100% fan-funded direct sequel to Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I retired up to Washington, and I've met some great filmmakers up here, and Brown Space Films with Jeremy Brown, and going to be doing first AD and production design work on Vengeance. And it's my goal. You know how you have bucket lists?
Yes.
My bucket list is to complete my quartet of the most important horror franchises.
I think I know what you're saying. We've got to get you on a Halloween film next.
That's right. Every time I say that, people go, well, okay, so Halloween's coming up, right? But
all right, guys, on Twitter, let's get it trending. Hashtag book Mick Strawn for Halloween 2020 whenever the next one comes out.
There you go. So I hear that you have some questions for me.
Okay, this one comes from actually one of my cohorts on the show, a gentleman by the name of St. Dick Eddie. Don't let the crazy name fool you. He's a good guy. What were some of your most difficult challenges you faced working on the film, working in the film industry?
You know, one of the weird things about it is we would just absolutely kill ourselves for very little pay. I mean, in proportion to working in LA, and because we were doing science fiction and we were doing horror and stuff like that, and I think that one of the frustrations, you know, you're looking at all your friends making, you know, buku bucks, you know, doing episodic TV or getting onto like Ordinary People or something like that, and you're like, you are literally up to your elbows in blood and mud and and sawdust and ashes, trying to having to work continuously, never taking any time off because you had to take the next thing that came up. And I think that the frustrations of being in that world overall have kind of recently been ameliorated because nobody ever thinks about all that other shit.
When you were working on Roger Corman's adaptation for Marvel Comics, The Fantastic Four, did you realize that it was never intended to be released?
Yeah, absolutely. I did realize that, and it's only because of Ole Sassoon that any of that ever got finished up, even as far as it did. And Ole literally stole, literally stole a VHS tape of the film and did his best to, like, get some effects done to it and stuff. That was the craziest thing ever. And I have to say, you know, from a production design point of view, considering we spent no money, and I mean no money, you know, Roger Corman says, well, yeah, no, I made that film for $1 million. Roger Corman never, you know what, the thing is he never even spent $1 million on anything in his fucking dreams, you know? I mean, he doesn't even do it in his sleep. spends $1 million on 20 films. Here's a true story. We had to have half the film done. This was the agreement. In order for Constantine to maintain their copyright on the characters, we had to have half of the film done January 1st. Now, we had literally, we were halfway through the filming schedule, which, by the way, I mean, I was on this film halfway through November was when I found out about the film.
Wow.
December, right? You can rag on me any way you want for how the film looked, but holy shit.
Oh, no. I think you're a miracle worker, if nothing else.
Literally, I was shitting scenery. You know? I mean, shitting fucking scenery. So, and there's so many great stories that go behind that whole thing, and we don't have time to get into it. But we were half done 4 days before. I was even surprised when I got a call to come back on, like, the 3rd of January.
Wow,
yeah. I was like, wow, really? Really? But the thing is, we had to, within 6 months, we had to assemble a version of the film, right? When I left, 4 days before the end of the year, when I left, there was this old man sitting on the stage that we did for The Mole Man, right? There's this guy and a director's chair, which really surprised the hell out of me because I knew for sure that he must have brought it with him because there were no director's chairs on that goddamn lot. Nobody would actually spend money for that. You've got to be kidding me. So I walk over to make sure that everything is closed down, right? And I walk over there. This is a lumber yard. This is a used lumber yard. Think of a lumber yard, right? You know where you got those big sheds, right, that they put the 2x4s in and shit, right? Okay. Take that concept and close the shed up on one side, and then on the other and it was like two of those sheds facing each other, which would have worked wonderful for a lumber yard. For a film studio, maybe not so much. So then the other side is the same, right? So I go in to make sure it's you know, closed down. There's this old man sitting with a legal pad in front of him, and he's scribbling down. He's looking around. He's sitting on the set. I come up to him, and I go, hey, I got to go. We're all done. I'm locking these off. All are two. Can I help you or something? He says, no problem. That's no problem. My name's Roger. I'll shut it before I go. And I go, okay. I go, well, it's Roger Corman. Okay. Well, there we go. So I leave. I come back 4 days. And I ask him, so well, what are you doing here? He says, I like this set a lot. I just kind of writing some script ideas down. And I thought, yeah, bad chance. We're going to be back in four. We're going to be back in 6 days. That motherfucker, when I got back there, everything was repainted. Everything was moved around. They had fucking filmed two films, I found out, in our sets while we were gone.
In that short amount of time?
Oh, you see, now you know you're talking about Roger Corman.
Oh, my God.
We used to think to ourselves, we used to get people's resumes. And let me tell you, and this is an honest thing. You would get somebody's resume that was like, maybe a grip, right? And you would see that they had done 30 films in 6 months.
They're all Roger Corman films?
Well, yeah, you would know. And you would go, and, you know, even if they, and the thing is what you would do is you put the titles in, and you wouldn't put the company name on them, right? So if you looked at somebody's resume, and in 6 months they had 30 films, and they hadn't put the name of the production companies next to it.
Gotcha.
They were working at Corman.
It's truly incredible. Mick, I can't thank you enough. I feel like we've only scratched the surface. Time permitting, sometime down the line, we'd love to have you back on the show. This has been great. I love all the insight you've given us from Nightmare on Elm Street down to the unreleased Roger Corman Fantastic Four.
I have a story or two, you know.
It sounds like you are quite full of many joyous stories. You want to tell everybody where they can find you on social media?
You know what? Social media, Mixtron on Facebook. You can get a hold of me that way. I'm on Instagram, although I very rarely look at it. I think I'm on Twitter, but I really don't care. The thing is Twitter assumes that you can cut yourself off with 120 characters, and I have never been able to cut anything that I say off down to 120 characters, as you may now know.
Well, I would say you're a better man for it. All the better for more colorful of stories.
There you go. I do have a podcast called podcast Dream Warrior Review. My friend Kirk Thomas and I, we rail about a given film that, you know, has come out. We do a review and then I babble about, you know, filmmaking, and you can hear all my stupid opinions.
I'm sure all of them are stupid.
Well,
that's my attempt at humor.
I just, not all of them are stupid. Thank you. Well, you know what? You should talk to my wife about that, because I'm sure that she would bring a different perspective to that thought.
All right. Well, we'll table the discussion for the opinion of your wife for another time. Nick, thank you so much. Everybody stay tuned. We're going to hear some messages from our sponsors, and when we come back, we'll be doing a full-length commentary for none other than the great film that this gentleman we just talked to worked on, called Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. Stay tuned.
Thanks a lot.
Hello, everybody. I'm John, one half of the Sick on Cinema podcast. And nearly 2 years ago, me and my co-host Matt created this podcast to discuss the most disturbing films ever made. But since then, we've expanded to include films that are weird, disgusting, offbeat, and just cult cinema in general. You can hear us bi-weekly on iTunes and SoundCloud, or follow us on all your favorite social medias. So if mainstream film just isn't cutting for you, or just want to expand into extreme cinema, then just remember the podcast dedicated to the dark side of film. Sick on Cinema. Cinema. Cinema!
All right, Rand Army, making his long-awaited debut into the Black Lodge, a gentleman I have known for the better part of my life, for better and for worse.
Only for better.
Sitting to my left, a man I've wanted on the podcast since its inception, because in one form or another, he and I have been having basically these kind of deep thought movie conversations for the better part of 20 years now.
Oh, easily, but, you know, uncensored.
Uncensored, with much more hate speech that we won't spill out here.
just horrible stuff, but I'm here with my professional hat on today.
Oh yeah, we've only had a couple of shots. We're gonna save the drunkenness for later on, then we can shout to my neighbors and rub our dicks on their furniture and sconces.
Which
and stuff.
I have wiped them on their screens, outdoor screens before, and woke up thinking I had bruised my genitals.
I.e. he did not, but that's a story for another occasion. Happy birthday, Brandon. I bruised my dick. All right. Like I said before, sitting to my left, Mr. Fat Tony.
Yes. The one, the only, the greatest. Tipsy Tony right now. Sometimes drunk Tony. Always Fat Tony.
Now, we were going to have Stank Diggetti along for the ride, and unfortunately, due to circumstances beyond our control, he could not make it. Fat Tony, you've never had the pleasure of meeting Stank Diggetti.
I was looking forward to it, but unfortunately, he sounds like a bitch.
He is a bitch, and he has stank dick, so stinky that I'm glad he's not in my apartment right now. All right, ladies and gentlemen.
I must interject real quick. My dick is always fresh.
Always fresh. Always fresh, and I don't even know where to go with that.
I bought Nut Rub cologne. I got that for Christmas. I highly recommend it. Always have fresh nuts.
All right. Happy New Year, everybody, and get your nuts nice and fresh. All right. We're going to be queuing up A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. You're going to cue it up to the scene right at the very beginning when the New Line Cinema logo is going to be just about to careem onto your screen. And on the count of three, I'll say hit play. When I say hit play, hit play. All right. 3, 2, 1, play. All right. A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master was released on August 19th, 1988. It had a budget of $13 million. Its domestic box office was just shy of $50 million. So to say this movie turned a profit would be an understatement.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Is this not the most profitable Nightmare released?
As far as the
original canon.
Original films under the Nightmare banner, yes, it is. Now, when Freddy vs. Jason came out, they blew that number out of the water.
Yeah, of course.
But as far as just the standard Nightmare on Elm Street movies, this is the one that kind of tipped the scale. And actually, to a point, at that point, it was the most successful independent film ever made, which is fairly impressive in its own right. This movie has a 57 rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It's just shy of being fresh. It has an audience score of 43, which I found kind of interesting because this is sort of like the movie that's in between the one that everybody loves and this the turning of the tide, I guess.
With the younger audience, I believe you have a lot of drop off after 3, which is arguably the best or tied for the best, and you know, the drop in quality is noticeable, but this is by no means a bad movie whatsoever.
No, considering the fact that this movie was made during the writer's strike and its script, which we'll get into a little later, was kind of, they had to get it into production super quick, and it could have been made probably with a lot more thought and intent had it been able to have a gestation period. But on IMDb, this movie has a 5.7 out of 10 rating, which is, you know, right on the, you know, the decent level. However, Google users ranked it at 91% that they liked it. And I think that's probably more indicative of how people actually feel about
this
movie.
Yes, that is. I do believe.
And it has a Metascore of 56. This movie has a body count of 6, 7 if you include Freddy. That averages to 1 kill every 13 minutes. Not the most blood-soaked movie we've had here on the podcast.
Freddy never has been the most blood-soaked franchise.
Well, he likes to play with his prey a little more. You know, that whole gallows humor, which is a lot more evident in this film than previous ones. How do you feel about that? Do you think that this is like the turning point of Freddy becoming more rather than the killer?
The turning point, I believe, was in part 3 when they added what I believe to be the perfect mix of fright and humor. This does tip the scales over to kind of, and I believe when you're in the fourth movie in a horror franchise, that's really your only option. You know, the good horror franchises know this. Friday the 13th got really ridiculous after part four, part four being perfect. The Chucky movies, the fourth one, Bride of Chucky, is a straight up rom-com. So that's really the only way that you can't make Freddy scary after a certain point. But this is definitely the tipping point, and it is a negative overall in the franchise.
You know, at this point, Freddy became the cinematic version of James Bond. I mean, he's so loved, and I mean, obviously, Robert Englund, the tie-in with that character. I mean,
this is the first movie where he's definitely the central focus. Nobody cares about any of the actresses. That's why they replaced Patricia Arquette without a second thought with, you know, some other woman who could feel, because it's not about the kids anymore. It's about Freddy and how he's going to kill them.
Well, we'll get into the story later on as to why Patricia Arquette supposedly is not in this film. But this film does boast some of the actors from part 3, some of the Dream Warriors making their return to the screen. Also, Kristen's mother is in this film, reprising her role. And oddly enough, the little girl we're going to see here in a few moments, she's having her role reprised.
No, I did not know that.
That's a cool little piece of trivia. This movie was nominated and won several awards. It was nominated for Best Horror Film, Best Supporting Actor for Robert Englund, and Best Director for Rennie Harland at the Saturn Awards, which is sort of like the horror equivalent, or horror science fiction equivalent of the Oscars. It's a big deal, even to this day.
Well, Rennie Harland, of course, you know, he, correct me if I'm wrong, he directed Die Hard 2.
Die Hard 2,
and
yes.
I will argue this till the day I die. The pirate movie he did, which name's blanking for me, probably from the two shots
Cutthroat Island
is not the worst movie ever made. I see what they were going for. It was about 50 years too late, but I believe he delivered the movie that he did want to deliver with that movie.
Oh, well, considering that movie had, I think at the time, the highest budget.
Oh, yeah. It ruined the whole film studio, didn't it?
Caraco Pictures, which was, crap.
I know
James Cameron.
I know it beat Heaven and Earth. I know it beat Heaven and Earth for, like, the highest budget versus, like, the biggest loss at the box office.
Yeah, it bankrupted James Cameron's Caraco Pictures, which is why we didn't end up getting James Cameron's Spider-Man, which was in pre-production around that time.
Having read the script online, thank you, Odin. I will sacrifice a ram in your name for that.
I agree. I want to get this out of the way. Now, longtime listeners of the podcast know that my all-time favorite film is Ghostbusters, and Tony, I would imagine
absolutely that's all-time favorite movie.
So I'm going to go ahead and knock this out. Very, very short connection to this film. Rennie Harlan directed The Long Kiss Goodnight with Gina Davis. She was in Tootsie with Bill Murray, who was in Ghostbusters. So there's your super quick connection to those films.
Everything connects to Ghostbusters.
Oh, I have yet to be stumped. So if you want to be the first to try, go ahead and do it. But I got to tell you, I got a mind like a steel trap when it comes to Ghostbusters. So let's talk a little bit more about Rennie Harlan. He got this role, or the role of the director, by sheer determination. He kept going to New Line's offices, and he showed up, and you know, he was fresh off the boat from Finland. He had directed a movie called Prison. Did you ever see Prison?
I did see Prison. It's a pretty good movie.
For a low-budget movie made for $1 million, I mean, it's terrific. That's actually the reason that Kane Hodder and John Beekler ended up getting to make Friday the 13th Part 7 is because of their pairing on that film. So Prison is a more important movie than I think a lot of people realize, because it got Rennie Harlan the job on this film, and it got Beekler and Kane Hodder the roles and directing duties for Friday the 13th Part 7. So that in of itself is sort of an interesting direction to go in. Like we stated before, Die Hard 2, Die Harder with Bruce Willis. He also directed The Adventures of Ford Fairlane with Andrew Dice Clay.
I'm sorry, I love that movie.
It is a great movie. I love Andrew Dice Clay, and I know he's totally politically incorrect for the climate that we live in these days, but he's funny. Come on.
But that movie did ruin most of my young adulthood trying to find a flammable milkshake.
I haven't seen it in quite a while, but I do remember that. It's actually up here on the shelf somewhere.
I actually watched it on some streaming service. I don't know if it was Amazon, Hulu. I know it wasn't Netflix. Probably about 6 months ago. It holds up surprisingly well.
I like it, and I also like, is it the Brain Smashers that he made that?
With, Brain Smashers,
yeah,
yes.
With Wayne Newton, the villain in that film. You know who's in Ford Fairlane, who's also in this movie?
Who?
Robert Englund.
That's right.
Yes, yes. So Rennie Harlan kept the people that got him to the dance, he kept them close to the vest. He also, as I stated before, he directed The Long Kiss Goodnight with Gina Davis and Samuel L. Motherfucking Jackson.
Motherfucking Jackson. Now, that's an underrated movie.
I want to talk about this film because my stepfather, his hall pass, by all accounts, is Gina Davis. So if she were to walk in here today, him and my mother probably would have a big blowout fight over that.
Well, if it's his hall pass, there should be no fight.
I agree. My mom's hall pass is Rod Stewart, so I don't know who makes out better in that end. Rod Stewart.
Gina, your stepdad definitely makes out better.
My favorite Gina Davis performance is in Transylvania 6000.
I was about to say Transylvania 6000. I watched that at a very formative age, and I believe that movie was the movie that incited my puberty.
Actually, you're bringing this up. That was probably one of the early ones I remember having repetitious self-love-making.
Why do I love this movie so much?
Batman Returns was the first one I ever realized that there was a direct correlation between an erection and an erotic female form. Yeah. Oh my God, Michelle Pfeiffer in that cat suit. Okay.
I have to interject here real quick. I was talking to Brandon about this before the podcast. One thing I do love about this movie that is so 80s is how they cast the quote unquote ugly, awkward, and nerdy chicks. Is they're in the parking lot right now meeting everybody. The sister, The only thing is she doesn't have a lot of makeup and her hair is flat. And in the 80s, if you had flat hair, that was anathema. And here coming up right now is the quote unquote nerd who is, and I'm sorry to sound sexist, a solid 8, but let's put glasses on her and a frumpy outfit. And she's the smart nerd. I love 80s movies nerds. I do believe that's why to this day I have a glasses fetish.
Oh, me too. Big time. Big time, big time.
By the way, for those people listening, Brandon has glasses on right now.
I do right now. I'm getting old. My eyesight sucks. And I've got extensive notes, so I'll make sure that I don't miss anything. The young lady he's referring to, her name is Toy Newkirk. She plays the role of Sheila. She had a fairly decent career in television. She was in a few episodes of A Different World. She has some small roles on 227, Beverly Hills 90210, The Commish, Living Single. She has a on-screen kiss with Freddy Krueger later on in the movie, and oddly enough, that is her first on-screen kiss of her career.
What better first kiss can there be?
Let's suck face. I mean, come on. I mean, that's
Freddy recognized her true beauty.
He did. He sucked the life right out of her. Would you, in the same position, would you suck the life out of her?
Maybe not to the point of murder, but given a consensual chance to make out with her, I would definitely, if I weren't with the best woman ever, shout out to my fiance Sarah, definitely participate in a little suck facing.
Oh, another, let's say about while we're bringing up Sarah, yeah. Would you like to take another dig at Eddie because your fiance let you come?
My fiance not only let me come, she encouraged me to come. And, you know, as a guy, I'm always like, are you sure? You set me up. Well, I'm with the perfect woman who will straight up tell me, no, get the fuck out. Go have fun, get drunk, do his podcast. And I told her I was going to give her a special shout out on this podcast. And being just the badass woman that she is, she's like, oh, well, I can't wait not to hear that because podcasts, unfortunately, are not her thing. But me being me, I'm definitely going to make her listen to this.
Well, make her download her at least a handful of times. I need those.
Oh,
listens.
Absolutely. Everybody. Rants from the Last Podcast. Google Play.
Rants from the Black Lodge.
Sorry. Rants from the Black Lodge. I've had a very long week. Rants from the Black Lodge. Google Play. iTunes. So anywhere you see it, subscribe to it. Download. This man is a genius.
Oh, I don't know that I would go that far, but I appreciate the endorsement.
Thanks for the $20.
whoever thought I had $20 to throw around? That's ridiculous. I'm broke. All right, this movie was made. Oh, I'm getting a call. I'm gonna turn my phone off. You should think I should know better than that. After doing this for the better part of a year, I'm gonna turn that off right now. This movie was written right during a writer's strike, and there have been a handful in our lifetime.
Absolutely, killed the show Heroes.
It killed the show Reaper as well.
Yeah, I terrific, love that show.
Terrific show. Well, they'd already greenlit this picture, and a gentleman by the name of Brian Helgeland, I can't pronounce his name, Helgeland, whatever, he wrote a bunch of stuff, great movies, even some movies that are, you know, Oscar caliber, but he had to kind of phone this in, and I know that's probably not the best term, because he did the best he could under the circumstances, but had this movie had another few passovers, it probably could have been a movie, you know,
on par with Part 3. Part 3 had a lot of passovers, a lot of time was taken with it, this one unfortunately didn't.
Well, Frank Darabont did the rewrites on Part 3, so, I mean, that...
And he made it, but I enjoy his vision of what Part 3 became over Wes Craven, and who was the other guy? I can't remember. There were two writers on that, you know, they did an okay, and then Frank Darabont kicked it up a notch.
Listen, I don't want to speak ill of Wes Craven.
I love the man.
But Wes had some wacky ideas, and I may be the one of the few people who genuinely loves A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2.
I do, too. It is very underrated. It is psychologically nasty. People shit on all the time from the view of the sequels, 3, 4, 5. It breaks the rules. There were no rules when they wrote that.
At that time.
Technically, 3, 4, and 5 broke the rules Part 2 laid down.
That's definitely a viewpoint I don't hear a lot of people speaking, so thank you for being a defender of
well, part I am a genius.
That's a discussion for another time. I will say this, you know, the weird conversations, the drunken hours of conversation that you and I have had over some of the worst movies of all time, it's nice to be able to have a insightful conversation about a good movie, and I do think this is a good movie.
Absolutely.
Just to run down this guy's work, he wrote 976 Evil, which was the directorial debut of Robert Englund. He did two episodes of the Friday the 13th series, which I will defend.
Very underrated show.
Great show.
You said nightmares as a child from watching that.
It's not quite Twin Peaks.
No.
But it served the purpose. Well, that's true. But it kind of laid the groundwork for X-Files and Millennium and those shows that came later.
I can
see
that.
Highway to Hell, which stars C.J. Graham, a.k.a. Jason, from Friday the 13th Part 6, which is available in our archives. Go check that episode out. L.A. Confidential.
What?
He wrote L.A. Confidential, yeah. Which is a terrific movie. It stars that kitty diddler, Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. We won't even get into his whole weird YouTube video as Frank from House of Cards, but needless to say, he ruined that and Usual Suspects for me. And Usual Suspects usually hung in my top 10, but not even his accusation. That video about his accusation has now, I retroactively cannot watch anything he's in.
I may be in the minority, but I don't like Usual Suspects. To me,
You're wrong.
I mean, I will take that on the chin. If I'm incorrect, then I'm incorrect. But to me, the Usual Suspects is like an episode of Scooby-Doo.
I can see that parallel, but are you trash talking Scooby Doo, who have featured a movie on your podcast of Scooby Doo? Check and mate,
all
I
right,
win.
All right, we'll table this discussion.
I do have to interject this actor right here. What is his name?
The black gentleman. That's Ken Sagans.
Ken Sagans. I got to meet at a very small convention.
We met him together.
And talked to him for about 2 minutes. And I'm not dissing him. I could not understand a word he said, but he did have, and I do regret to this day, not paying for his autograph, because he didn't just autograph. He did these amazing little doodles like "fuck Freddy, pussy," and signed his name. But I don't know if he was drunk, tired, or just the acoustics of the place. I could not understand a word out of that man's mouth.
Yeah, listen, he was very nice, but I struggled to understand him as well, and I don't want to speak ill of him, but he to me, I think he had been drinking.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're doing as small a conventions as that was, for perspective, there was like the sheriff character from the Ernest movies there who we met.
Oh, yeah, Billy Brick, yeah.
Very nice man, and who did it for charity. This was very, I mean, they had some kids from Swamp Thing, too. This isn't the top
Daniel
tier.
Emery Taylor.
I remember. Yeah, see, this is why Brandon's
the return
genius.
Of Swamp Thing, which is Swamp Thing, too.
Yeah, he has
directed by Jim Wynorski.
He has the mind for the minutia. But if you're at that kind of convention, why not be drunk? I'm not hating on him.
You know Reggie Bannister from the Phantasm movies.
Absolutely.
I was at a convention in Nashville, and I mean, to say he was drunk would be the understatement of a lifetime. Good friend of both of ours, Matt Underwood.
Oh, yeah.
We're standing there, and Matt's just a generally nervous person. I'm not talking shit about you, Matt. It's just
you are.
Speaking truth.
We love you.
And even Matt had a good giggle. He's like, man, he's drunk. And he kept just shaking his glass, and you heard the...
No, he's like,
the ice
drunk.
Jiggling. Like, bring me another drink, bar wench.
I would too.
Let's take a moment to look at the production design of a gentleman who we just do an awesome interview with, the legendary Mick Strawn. He tells the story about how they got this whole junkyard. They cleared out a lot. They bought tons of cars and they laid this whole thing out.
Okay, whatever people might say about, and then you have the hipsters that complain that after part, it's 1 and 3 and those are the only good ones. Really starting with part 4, well, starting with part 3, but part 4 and part 5, however you view them, they took set design, they took special effects, they took these movies seriously. One of the first Fangoria issues I remember buying when it first came out was the issue talking about Nightmare on Elm Street part 4 and how they pulled off the effect at the end and the care they took with it. And these movies really do show that. However you might feel about these movies, and if you don't like them, you are definitely wrong. and you're probably not a good person, but that's okay because I still love you. I'm not a good person by any stretch of the imagination, but I do enjoy these movies. But they took real care with the look of these movies. This movie, some aspects you can argue make sense or not. But like you said, this was written in a rush crisis mode. But, you know, these movies did care about how they looked. What, you know, they didn't just shove stuff off to the audience, which, and I hate to say this, I'm sorry if this upsets Brandon for disparaging, Freddy's Dead felt really rushed. It is the only movie of the original canon, I still count it canon, that I can say I love, but I love because it's a bad movie. These other movies I love.
I actually saw Freddy's Dead in the theater.
I did too.
And
I had to keep telling people, leave your 3D glasses off till the end. It says it right here. Little kid being a jerk.
I really liked it, but I mean, you have to take into consideration that, I mean, even though, I mean, like, we're both close to the same age, but yeah, I was a little...
I'm about 3 years older, and at that time, 3 years was a big difference. I still loved it when I saw it in the theater, because I was, what year did it come out, 91?
Yeah, 91, I believe.
91, so I was 10 years old. That puts you about 7 or 8, 6, between 6
I was 7.
So, you know, and they really are, there's no attempt to scare in those movies. And they did do the whole 3D gimmick, and I guess you could say, but
as a kid, though, the 3D gimmick was awesome.
Oh, absolutely. But 3, 4, and 5 is really when they stepped up the special effects game and, you know, learning about that through Fangoria, which I lost that auction, by the way. There's a whole long story about that.
He was about to win a crate full of Fangorias from a library. I'm going to interject right here. This gentleman we're seeing on screen, that's Rodney Eastman. He's reprising his role of Joey. He was in a bunch of movies, and this guy actually has one of the longer credits, film acting credits.
Very disturbing in Last House on the Left remake.
Yeah, he's
a movie
he's
so disturbing that me and Brandon, we had to start joking and cutting up, or we would have not been able to make it through that movie. Yeah,
it is. Show me your teeth. It's a disturbing sure. movie. But I want to before I get to his whole rundown, because God, he's got a ton. I want to talk about this scene right here. As a kid, this is probably the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie I saw all the way through. And
part three was the first one for me.
My aunt and uncle had a satellite back when that was like a big
deal. Oh yeah, absolutely.
And they had Cinemax, and they recorded this on a bunch of, you know, but VHS, like a tape, man. Like I had an SLT, a whole stack of SLP tape, eight movies on a cassette. And this scene, I rewatched this scene to the point where you could not see anything, because that was the only option for a naked lady I had for the longest time.
You kids these days are spoiled.
They're fucking coddled.
I found a water-soaked penthouse one day walking to the grocery store, and it was one of the greatest days of my childhood.
Oh, they'll never know.
They'll never know.
There's actually some awesome behind-the-scenes footage of Freddy's stunt double in this scene where he's like, we've been shooting this for 6 hours. If you can't get us the next shot, I'm fucking done.
Where did you see that? Because I remember I've watched the Never Sleep Alone.
It's Never Sleep Again. And Never Sleep Again. It is during the Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4 section that
okay.
you see. Okay,
that's a very long movie, and I watched it on a computer back before high-speed internet was real. I mean, we had high-speed, that's why I was able to watch it, but I was in my kitchen, a hardwood chair. I got up and smoked a lot.
It is very long, as is the Crystal Lake Memories of the Friday the 13th. Let's talk a little more about Rodney. He's in Chopping Mall, yet again, directed by Jim Wynorski. I'm giving him the plug of a lifetime. Even though you won't be on the podcast.
We still love you.
We still love you. You did Return of Swamp Thing, terrific movie.
I love that movie.
And Cheerleader Massacre, which is an official sequel to Sleepaway Camp. But anyways, he was in a few episodes of Charles in Charge. He was in, like you said before, the I Spit on Your Grave remake, which is terrific. CSI, Who's the Boss, Jake and the Fat Man, Babylon 5, Touched by an Angel, Murder, She Wrote, ER, Sliders, Millennium, which is the most underrated show of its time. Only went 3 seasons. Didn't get a proper finale until they did a throwaway episode in the X-Files. And it just, Lance Henriksen deserves better.
He absolutely does.
You know, they wrote, James Cameron wrote the Terminator for him. And the studio wanted
O.J. Simpson.
And
they had a good eye. They could see the future.
Well, he didn't get the role because they're like, well, they're not going to give this role to... He's too nice. This guy would never murder anybody. sadness. But yeah, he's been in so many things.
Officially declared innocent. Yeah, just had to say that for legal reasons.
Yeah, on the...
But did time in prison for hanging a man outside the window.
That's true.
But the man had his stuff, so I'm still conflicted about that. You know, I agree he shouldn't have done that, but you live, you learn. Full disclosure, I myself have done prison time for being too awesome.
That's true. Eight to ten for
for just for, being amazing. Being a fucking legend.
The I have this literally written down in my notes. Slut in waterbed. Her name is Hope Marie Carlton.
Let's not. If you just like sex,
if you hear this, that's a joke. You're probably not a slut, but if you are, DM me on Twitter at Rance Black Lodge.
Many a time, private time spent thinking about you and that thing.
She was a Playboy playmate. She. Did you ever see Hard Ticket to Hawaii?
I'm aware of that movie, but I never watched it.
Oh, I need to track it down because it's one of the best bad movies ever made, and she's scantily clad in that movie as well. She's in Slaughterhouse Rock, Slumber Party Massacre 3, Ghoulies 3, which is a terrible movie.
It's terrible, but I still like it.
So it's a fun movie. And she's also in The Stand, which is a common thread I found. A lot of these people were in Stephen King made-for-TV adaptations. I know I'm getting off topic here, but the common thread of almost every actor of every episode we've done, they've all been in the X-Files. I mean, my top 10 favorite shows of all time, but it's just weird that there's this like common thread of everybody being in the X-Files.
Probably a lot of industry stuff. Oh, I know this person or that person who would do this or that. Love the show. I would say probably one of my top 5 favorite shows of all time. Because, again, I am older and cooler than Brandon. I just don't have the mind for minutia. He's sexier, though. I'll give him that.
Yeah, by a smidge, though. Just a smidge.
If he shaved, he wouldn't be.
No. I got a weak chin.
He'd look 12.
Speaking of chins, this chin right here is giving it away. That's obviously Robert Englund.
Out of makeup. Bet he loved that scene. Just throw on a wig and some lipstick, and you're good to go.
I love his voice. The acting prowess of Robert Englund is not to be underestimated. What's your favorite role of Robert Englund aside from Freddy?
Aside from Freddy, his character on V. I remember watching that Willy. As a child.
Willie, the friendly alien.
And I love that character. And when I found out much later that he was the guy playing Freddy, it kind of broke my heart a little because I was still young enough when I saw Nightmare on Elm Street 3 the first time, and I believe it was on Cinemax. That was the first one I saw all the way through, and it was, I believe, my older brother Brad that's like, he knew I liked V and mentioned, well, that's your friendly alien guy. He couldn't remember the name. He didn't say friendly. That's that, you know, wimpy alien from V, which that sounds nothing like my brother, but I am not Rich Little.
There's a reference for the past.
Yeah,
the kiddies won't get that one.
No, what are you talking about? All the kids are up on Rich Little. But definitely that's like, I don't have to think about it. That's definitely my favorite non-Freddy role.
I'm going to go with a dark horse, a little known Toby Hooper, project known as Eaten Alive.
Very good movie.
Yeah. Sort of the spiritual successor of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's just this really down and dirty exploitation movie. It takes place in the bayou. There's gators and sickles. And it's a really, really underrated movie. So I suggest you go.
First time I ever saw that, I bought one of those like $5 box sets of like 20 movies. At Walmart, and I'm like, what? There's a Toby Hooper movie.
Toby Hoopy.
I love those movies. Toby Hooper movie. Watched it, blown away. All the other 19 movies, complete garbage. There was, I believe, a lovely naked young woman in one of the other movies. Other than that, but it was definitely worth $5. Okay. I forgot he was in that until you just mentioned it. Robert Englund's in
the line. I mean, the guy's got an extensive resume. He works on a regular
basis. I also love him in Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
Terrific movie, which we're all longly awaiting the proposed sequel to it, and unfortunately, for whatever reason, it hasn't happened.
I'm conflicted.
We're four sequels in the hatchet, and we only have one Leslie Vernon movie. Come on, we can do better than those people.
People enjoy the gore and outlandishness, as do I, of Hatchet. But Hatchet had none of the subtlety and actual emotion and acting that The Rise of Leslie Vernon locked down.
At least not in the first one.
Well, you,
Daniel Harris put a little bit of...
Daniel Harris is always good in anything she's in, and I will get in a fist fight. If I had a hall pass, that would be who I'd want it on. I grew... Like, she is just slightly older than me. I grew up with Halloween 4 and 5, the biggest crush on Earth.
Yeah, she is still a fucking fox, man, and by all accounts...
And great in any really, movie she's
really,
in.
Really nice... hit us up on the Twitters, please, Miss Danielle Harris. We love you. Let's talk a little bit more about Robert Englund. I mean, obviously, you can't undersell the reasons these movies are so successful. I mean, it all comes down to Freddy being personified by the great Robert Englund. His version of Freddy Krueger was ranked number 40 on AFI's list of 100 greatest heroes and villains. A list that consists of both heroes and villains, and he's number 40 of 100. That's pretty impressive.
Well, I do also have to point out, amongst all the other popular horror franchises of the 80s, this is the oddball out because this killer has character and personality. He's not behind a mask. He's not a silent force of nature. He is a trickster god who just gleefully loves everything he's doing. And you can talk about... You know, certain sequels in the Slumber Party Mass. And nothing on this level. It was Halloween, Friday the 13th, and then Freddy. Halloween, obviously. Friday the 13th, obviously. It's all about a nonstop killing machine. Freddy gives the flair and personality. And he is, I definitely believe, starting with any other actor playing Freddy Krueger in the original, even under the great direction of Wes Craven and the great... overall originality of the story, I don't think it would work as well, but he definitely, definitely cemented that in part three.
Okay, well, you know, in part two, they started out shooting the movie with a different actor as Freddy Krueger.
I did not know that.
The scenes where, the homoerotic scenes where the coach is being whipped.
I don't remember that actor's name, Jesse's name.
Oh, God.
I met him in Sevierville at the Halloween Summit Convention. Gatlinburg, that's what I meant. What did I say? Sevierville? Gatlinburg. Sorry for anybody who lives around here. They hate it when you lump everything together.
Yeah, I totally
but
hate that. Yeah,
that was a very nice man. I've still yet to sit down and watch his documentary, I'm Not Jesse. I don't know if it ever got made.
I believe it is released. Out now.
He was a very nice man. I have nothing against the homosexual undertones. But how
to
the
me,
writer and director did not see those in the movie...
That's bullshit.
Baffles
the mind. How the fuck he did not see that stuff is just insane. Because it's so blatant. Personified in that scene. So the coach is getting whipped and he's having balls thrown at him. But it's just the most obvious
metaphor.
After
meeting a student at a leather S&M gay bar.
Exactly. But anyways, there's the scene where Freddy... There's like the steam and stuff and he walks through it. And Freddy has a way bigger build. So they hired a stuntman to play Freddy Krueger, and they started shooting the film, and they got the dailies back, and they're like, man, this is not working. And they didn't want to pay Robert Englund what he was worth.
That's the same problem that Gunnar Hansen ran into doing
the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Pay the actors what they're worth. They make it.
Yeah, well, the...
You could argue for the Leatherface more than, but you cannot argue that there is one Freddy, although I do like, I'm in the minority, I like Jackie Earle Haley's Freddy, but there is only one Freddy, and that is Robert motherfucking Englund.
Truth to that. Robert also has a pretty cool career. He's directed a few things. I stated before, he directed 976 Evil.
Fun, weird movie.
With Stephen Jeffries from Fright Night, the weird little kid.
Evil.
Yeah, he played Evil, yeah. Who turns into a vampire, and you feel genuinely bad when they have to kill him. Great movie. Fright Night, finally getting a full-fledged wide release on Blu-ray. I'm looking forward to that. He also directed a couple episodes of Freddy's Nightmares, which Freddy's Nightmares...
You could do a whole thing about that.
It spurned completely out because of the success of this movie, but yet again, New Line was producing things on the cheap, and those first couple episodes, they all looked pretty good for a low-budget TV show, and then after that, man, the budget got slashed to a point, figuratively and literally.
I was watching something about that show where it came to a point that the people making it just tried to see what they could get away with. You know, just like they just stopped caring, like, let's see how far we can take this, let's see what we can do. Because if you look at the time it came out and some of the subject matter in those episodes, it is absolutely... Is everything all right?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's absolutely pretty hardcore. Not gore or anything, but, you know...
Okay, well, the intention was that this show is going to be syndicated, and it would be playing, you know, like, after 10 o'clock. Well, the problem is... They showed it like, on weekdays in the middle, you know, middle of the day when like, you know, mom's usually watching...
Days of Our Lives.
And, you know, kids would be home and be playing on Saturdays when, like... when cartoons were on. So the target audience never really found the show, much like they did with the Friday 13th show, which was terrific until that third season and everything kind of fell into disarray. But Freddy's Nightmares is probably best remembered as the Enterprise that gave us a backstory to Freddy Krueger.
Absolutely.
The first two episodes, I want to say it was the first two episodes, served as sort of like a, almost like an unofficial movie, directed by Tobe Hooper.
Well, I don't know that it was too sequentially, because I know the first one was the prequel, the background, the cop, and I thought the episode with the cop's twin daughters, I thought that was a couple episodes later. Was that the second episode?
I believe it was.
Okay, I'll defer to you.
Here's the thing, though. Because it was syndicated, there's a possibility that even though it was the production order, they may not have been released.
And it would have made sense to produce. You already have the actresses there. I love the conceit of that episode where the twin daughter, like one twin won't believe the other, so the other just lets Freddy cut her, and then the other twin is cut. Great episode. I'll still, in my heart, consider those two episodes canon.
I
do not consider the one where the photographer is taking pictures of models and Freddy, and she knocks him out and Freddy kills him and she takes pictures. That is not canon in my heart.
The only thing I don't like about the prequel episodes directed by Tobe Hooper is when they're in the courtroom, Freddy is wearing his striped sweater.
Absolutely.
I thought that was it's a little
and the corny. Freddy vision, like the way the screen, like the camera distorted when you're looking through Freddy's eyes, which, you know, a lot of serial killers have brain damage. Maybe that explains Mr. Krueger, but that was it was a new camera effect. They wanted to show it off. Kind of dumb. Other than that, it's flawed, but worth the watch.
I'll agree with that. I mean, if you can find it, I have a bootleg copy of all the Freddy episodes. I know it's been released on DVD in like foreign countries, but never in America to my knowledge. One last thing about Robert Englund before we hitch a ride onto some other people in this film. I couldn't find 100% confirmation on this, but I believe this to be true. But evidently Robert was considered for the role of Mr. Joshua in Lethal Weapon that ultimately went to Gary Busey.
Thankfully went to Gary Busey.
Well, I love Robert, but Gary Busey, that's a role that is synonymous with him, and only crazy giant-toothed Gary Busey could play a role like that. Let's talk a little bit about Tuesday Knight, who unfortunately took over the role for Patricia Arquette. We're actually probably in her
very fortunately for her.
I don't know. I like Patricia Arquette in part three, and I guess it would have been nice to have her have been in this movie for the sake of continuity, but I really like Tuesday Knight. There's a really naturalistic quality to her.
Oh yeah.
That, she's really sweet, and some of her line delivery to me, like, a lot of times, especially in horror movies, and even the best genre actors, I can tell they've been rehearsed, and you hear them say things, and like, well, I can hear them, they've said that, like, how many times through all these different takes. I don't know, she just comes off as very natural to me.
Yeah.
But she has a background. Her father, Baker Knight, was a musician back in the old days. He wrote a song called Lonesome Town and The Wonder of You. They were big hits back in their day. But music is something that has ran through, through her family. She was actually, the year before this movie came out, she released a self-titled album and of music. She was signed to Vanity Records, but after backing vocals, she did backing vocals for Quiet Riot. Like, as in, like,
well, that's metal, just fucking amazing.
Metal Health, the 1984. Oh, well, then the first metal album legit to ever go number one. She sang backing vocals on that album, and I guess they were like, well, shit, we've got to sign her to a record deal. So Vanity Records signed her, but after I guess, you know, there was all this, what's the word I'm looking for?
Hype. I've got to pause you. I'm sorry. I've never noticed that Nancy's tombstone is in the background of a shot in here when they're in the cemetery. And I've seen this movie a billion times. Well, I am an idiot.
Well, I can't 100% credit that to Mick Strawn, but fuck it. I'm going to give Mick Strawn credit for that. Mick, thank you so much for paying attention to continuity. But like I was saying before, there was all this hype around her album, and CBS Records bought her contract out, and she released this album. It did fairly well. She actually did a cover of Prince's song, Why You Want to Treat Me So Bad. It wasn't the single off of it. Probably should have been, probably in retrospect, because, you know,
name recognition.
Prince at the time was, you know, probably...
That was peak Prince.
Just at the plateau of his career, you know, your post... Purple Rain, pre-Graffiti Bridge. So it's right at that.
I know positive. Purple Rain past that. Brandon is the Prince fan. I appreciate what the man did, but if I could at gunpoint name maybe four Prince songs.
Oh, well, shit.
And I've seen the man live. It's a great show.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him on the Musicology tour.
Did you not see that with my fiance?
I did see that with Sarah.
You did.
Oh, fuck, man. Small world. That was a great concert. Until I saw Iron Maiden, that was the best concert I had ever been to. And Iron Maiden, hard to beat. And since then, you know, I've seen Judas Priest,
Black Sabbath on the same tour.
I can't win that. Black Sabbath, greatest band of all time.
Point. All time, and dunk. I will fight you.
I will fight you as well. They changed music, period. No doubt about it.
Gods.
Metal gods. But okay.
Back to this.
I'm gonna jump ahead just a bit. We had a question from our friend of ours, Matt Underwood, wanted to know what Tuesday Night is up to these days. Well, in 2000, her and Lisa Wilcox, who we're gonna get to in just a moment, who plays our main protagonist, they founded a footwear jewelry company called Tobrite. She has a specific line called Tuesday's Hip Vintage, and evidently it's become really popular with, like, famous people, like Britney Spears, Angelina Jolie, Madonna, all wear her stuff. So even though, like, she's not, like, in the acting spotlight anymore, she still has this legacy. She's
doing well.
So, yeah, I mean, she's still raking it in. And I have to say, I don't know what it is. But the older she gets, the more attractive I find her.
I saw the preview, I think you might have posted, or somebody, about the new Freddie...
Fredheads
documentary. Saw her looking good.
She's got, I don't know, there's something about her round face that just does it for me.
And,
I want to pinch them cheeks.
What's her name?
That is Lisa Wilcox.
I'm really horrible with names, but, still, I mean, she's showing her age, but in a very... sexy way. I'm sorry. Nah. I hate to objectify. Now, this is okay. I know you don't have to follow along with the movie, but we're coming up to the Freddy's makeout session. And this is, I remember seeing this as a kid. I think it had just come out. My older sister and older brother, well, my older sister already had a kid by then, but my older brother would spend every other weekend with us, you know, because he was my dad's son. And I remember this came out, so he rented this. And for some reason, this kill, mind you, I'm very little, scared the shit out of me. This whole scene, starting with the moving math and Freddy and the little husk that is left, absolutely terrified me. And I could not go to sleep till probably 3 o'clock in the morning that weekend I first saw it.
I, you know, I...
Young me was a pussy.
Well, no, no. I mean, I'm not gonna call you out for that, because what scares someone at that particular age, especially when you discover horror films,
start to learn about death, you know, in general.
Freddy never really scared me. Now, some of that had to do with that, like, I saw probably the later movies first. So I had more of this jokey idea of Freddy in my head before I ever saw part one and part two, which I'll say genuinely has some really scary scenes in them. But this is super creative.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, like four and five, even though five, a lot of people, that's their least favorite. They did a lot of creative, they made a lot of creative choices.
I hate the way Freddy looks in that movie, but I love the set design and the gothic nature of that. We watched that back in July.
I got to be home alone while my great fiance was visiting a brother in California, and we got very drunk and got in a conversation about that too.
It's an underrated film. I feel like the downfall of a lot of slasher movies is because they're so cheap to produce, they had to crank them out at such a breakneck pace that they didn't leave a lot of time to really develop the stories. And, I mean, you could argue that this film probably came out too quick, but it has a reason why it's probably more disjointed than it could be. Part 5 doesn't have... And there's no excuse for that. They went too fast to get that movie into theaters, and the story suffers. Although, albeit, you know, the visuals in that movie are really
good.
And
it's kind of original. It's the execution versus the inception of the idea. Just, it didn't level out. You know, Freddy taking over a kid could have gone somewhere good. Using the dreams was an interesting thing. They never really harp on it. I didn't understand that until probably my fifth time watching the movie, that Freddy was using the baby's dreams to get live people. And then even my young 12-year-old, I might have been, I saw it before the, so 10-year-old brain was like, well, how does that work? Part 4. Yeah, we're back to this. Lisa Wilcox.
So Lisa Wilcox, who plays Alice, she reprises her role in Nightmare 5. A lot of people fondly remember her as kind of being...
Say what you want about 5. Alice and Lisa Wilcox, solid.
Now, I can't 100% confirm. I don't actually think it's her breast in the movie.
I saw something that it was definitely a body double.
But her very character, disappointed. Her character is naked in the movie, and as a kid, that's all I needed.
Oh, exactly.
Nudity is something this film actually kind of lacks.
Like, you got the one scene there, the lovely lady in the waterbed, because I would never write slut. And that's about it.
Linnea Quigley has a small role in this film, and I will point it out. You're going to have a part where Freddy's chest of souls is going to be erupting.
Yeah, I didn't count those in that nudity, but yes.
Technically, she's nude in the movie, but there's a dental dam covering her, so that's one of those, like...
I didn't know that was her, because I follow, I think it's Nightmare Sisters on Facebook. She's part of that, and... A lot of stuff about those cheesy 80s horror movies.
While we're on the subject of Linnea Quigley, where does she rank, like, as, like, most bangable horror hotties of all time?
Fucking top three?
She might be number one.
She might be number one.
Night of the Demons, the part where she's in the grocery store, and she's wearing those pink panties, and she bends over to distract the guy so they can steal stuff. That's my childhood puberty right there.
I probably made myself raw and bleed from that. But then also in that same movie, when she shoves the lipstick into her nipples, another movie that weirdly freaked me out. Like that scene. I mean, that's a more...
I know we're getting a little off track, but okay. Have you ever seen the remake of Night of the Demons?
I watched it once and forgot about it almost immediately.
Yeah, they take that
Shannon
scene...
Shannon Elizabeth, isn't it? Or Edward Furlong?
Edward Furlong, Shannon Elizabeth, yeah. Tiffany Shepis.
I bought it and forgot about it.
Yeah, well, they recreate the lipstick scene.
I do remember that.
But it's, they go way further with it, and to a point where it ceases being camp and just turns out to all-out disgustingness. Lisa Wilcox, she auditioned for the role of the main character of Rachel in Halloween 4, as did Ellie Cornell audition for the role of Lisa, of Alice, who got the role of Lisa, who got the role.
Lisa got the role.
But it ended up, you know, kind of the way I guess it probably should have.
Absolutely.
Ellie Cornell is perfect in Halloween 4, and Lisa Wilcox, I mean, she's the personification of what this character
absolutely
is. She even credits that, like, so much of what this character is on page is kind of how she viewed herself at the time. She thought she would never have a boyfriend and that kind of stuff. And I got to tell you, like, man, if I, God, even now, I would, she could be 70 years old. I'll break your fucking hip, man.
The quote unquote frumpy Alice. And this is one of the few horror movies that actually gives like a real character arc to their protagonist instead of just survive, kill the bad guy, move on. Like, you see her character progress, and I joked about the flat hair, but in this scene, you could tell there's been conditioner. It's slightly lumped up. She's got the first soul in her collection, you know, because she is the Dream Master. And it does, I personally don't see how she could ever see, but maybe bringing those insecurities really helped this role, period. Like I said, for a slasher movie, she's one of the few heroines that she really gets a complete arc through 4 and 5.
That's true. Now, I'm not sure how far you've read, but I have read Freddy vs. Jason and its sequel, Freddy vs. Jason. Oh, Freddy vs. Jason vs. Ash.
See, I actually...
Nightmare Warriors.
I actually skipped that. Like, I didn't know that existed, and I bought it at a convention we went to. Freddy vs. Jason vs. The one where Freddy takes over Washington.
Nightmare Warriors.
Yeah.
That movie... I mean, her character is front and center in that, and they bring all the survivors of the respective genres together.
Slaughter film.
And that was written by Jeff Katz, who I have to say, like, if this had been a movie, it probably would have been unfilmable, but man, what a
amazing
fucking ride. One of the best comic adaptations of all time. I still have to say fuck you to Jeff Katz, because he's the reason that Kane Hodder wasn't in Freddy vs. Jason. So fuck you, Jeff Katz, but thank you for doing
an awesome
adaptation.
And what was the name of the gentleman who was in Freddy vs. Jason? Because I don't want to take anything from him.
Ken Kurzinger.
He was at that Gatlinburg convention, wasn't he? He was at one of them. I mean, he was a very nice man. He did a good job. Kane Hodder is Jason.
Listen, like, as the way Jason was written in the movie, he probably wasn't correct for the role, but the way the movie was directed, he is what the director wanted. So,
really,
Ken Gerzinger was fine. Here we have a gentleman giving a lecture. Yes,
I spoiled it. I'm sorry.
Bob, that's fine. It's what you're here for.
He's cutting me with a razor blade as we speak.
It's dull, so it's extra painful. Bob Shea, pretty much the success of New Line all rested on his shoulder, because New Line didn't produce movies until they produced Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, they were a distribution company,
and they called New Line the house that Freddy built. Now, New Line became a Oscar-winning production company with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but they would have never gotten off the ground had it not been for the Nightmare on Elm Street series and House Party. They also produced the first two or three Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies, which were... The first one's really good.
The first one's great. The second one I liked when I was a little kid, but I was just old enough to be embarrassed by the Vanilla Ice cameo in the dance. The third one I watched way later on VHS, and I'm glad it's horrible. I do have to say this about Bob Shea, though. The good and the bad. We have the Freddy franchise only because of him. He's the one that insisted Wes Craven leave it open to a sequel. Kind of money hungry, but I'm glad he did it, even though it does speak to more greedy intentions. Peter Jackson originally intended Lord of the Rings to be two movies, and he's the one that looked at Peter Jackson and said, well, aren't there three books? Three movies. Yeah. So I'll give the man props. Artistically, sometimes he can make the right choice. Greedily, he can sometimes make the right choice, but without him, we would not be enjoying the movie I'm watching right now.
I mean, it truly is sad, because he built this company, and then they had the AOL Time Warner merger, and he got ousted. So the guy who got them to the promised land got removed from his position. That's so
sad. I'm sure he's doing okay, though.
Well, I'm sure he is as well, but it's still sad in any regard that the man who got them to this point is no longer there.
Okay, I have to stop. We are at the point in the movie where there is an invisible kung fu fight, and I bring this up not just because it is funny. This is the absolute point in the movie where it becomes a balls out comedy. Before he killed the first two original survivors from part three in down gritty, the, you know, sets and locations, he threw
Kristen into the fire. The thing.
His first non Elm Street kid kill. Maybe you could say, well, the character wanted to have fun. He's not constrained anymore. But I think for the movie, they just wanted to kick it up.
Okay. Well, when I spoke with Mick, he told me that they were like 15 grand in the hole before they even started filming. So
then an invisible fight makes sense.
When they got to this scene, they had no money. So this was a means to an end. Now, in context, this is like classic Freddy. It makes absolute sense.
One of the most memorable scenes in the movie.
But this is one of those scenes where people kind of tear it a new asshole. Like, okay, haha, Freddy's invisible.
If you watch any kung fu movies, you know all about fighting with a blindfold. It made sense. Screw you. But I love you.
Man, they spent a lot of time in this cemetery throughout
the movie.
Is
this the same Korean cemetery they used in part three? Because I know part three, they couldn't show the wording on the tombstones because it was a Korean or Japanese cemetery, and none of it was in English. I just didn't know.
To my knowledge, it's not the same.
No, it doesn't kind of, it doesn't place, look the same.
But, you know, I am on occasion potentially wrong. So feel free to do your own research, and if we're incorrect, drop us a line at Rance Black Lodge.
And feel privileged to correct us.
Lisa Wilcox, who plays Alice, she's been in quite a few things. Did you know that there was a live action Bill and Ted TV series in the 90s?
Oh, okay. I've seen that. No, I did not know there was a TV series. I did know there was a live action Bill and Ted. Can't wait for the third one.
Oh, yeah. Rock on, dude. I'm looking forward to it. But she was in 7 episodes of that. I didn't know this even existed.
I'm tracking it down.
I knew that there were 2 animated series.
I didn't know about those.
But I had no
idea.
I didn't
know there were 2. I knew there were 1. But
She had some smaller roles in Hardcastle and McCormick, General Hospital, Mr. Belvedere, MacGyver.
I remember the Mr. Belvedere. That's one of my all-time favorite 80s shows. I remember her when she was in it.
What do you remember?
The only reason I remember it is because I recently watched it not too long ago. METV
plays Mr.
Belvedere. I'm like, oh my God. And she's one of the few actresses out of these movies I can name her name. Lisa Wilcox, Heather Langenkamp, and John Saxon. Because there was a prior review to Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3 by a very esteemed internet critic called Drunk Tony. It's no longer available online, and probably for a good reason.
That is the understatement of a lifetime.
Yes.
All sorts of
very proud.
Forced,
I remember John
sexual
Saxon.
Love commentary on that.
We had to put a warning up, but I was very proud. I remember John Saxon's name in that. But
well, John Saxon is a legend.
But I was I did not use stunt booze in that review.
No, you were incredibly intoxicated. That was one of the funniest nights of my life.
Yes.
So feel free to go and try and track it down. Unfortunately, we think it may be lost to time. We may have this on a video cassette somewhere out there in the ether. We'll look for it. Maybe someday we'll uncover it.
We'll never show it to the public, but we'll look for it because we'll have a blast watching.
Yeah, I don't think society, as it stands, with as politically correct as they are, they can handle the things that you say.
I am a fiancé, a stepfather to 2 wonderful children, a great uncle and uncle. I cannot have this get out to the public because I was a deplorable human being, although it is easily the funniest thing I ever did.
I don't know that I'd go that far. It may be the funniest thing you've ever
done on film. On film. I did we were at a friend's house, and it was my idea to make a domestic abuse joke about Miller High Life.
that is available.
Yeah, that is available. Miller High Life. Next time she'll get it faster. That was amusing. And I'm also in a bra in that same video. Drunk Tony.
Luscious Tammy Mefford.
Luscious Tammy Mefford. I digress. I'm getting us off track. Her brother's been killed.
Yes, and he is played by Andrus Jones. He's also got a somewhat of a decent career in the film world.
I've seen him in stuff, but the only other movie I can remember him playing significant, and, you know, this was at a time where I didn't get a lot. It was in an insane, he was in some kind of group home for mental health. Seth Green is in
that,
it.
It's called The Attic Expeditions. Jeffrey Combs and Alice Cooper are in
that movie. Love that movie.
Yeah, they used to come on Cinemax, and I want to say Showtime a lot.
Here's how old I am, kids.
Early 2000s.
I rented it at Blockbuster.
How do you feel that there are no Blockbusters around anymore?
Blockbuster I always thought was overpriced.
There
is a Popcorn Video in my hometown of Greenville.
Shout out Popcorn Video.
We love you. I will give you money if I'm not renting a movie. Sometimes I hold movies late just to pay my late due.
We just missed it, but feel free to watch this movie at your leisure at another time. But there, when she's doing the nunchuck moves, and it shows the reverse shot of her from behind.
Yes.
It's obviously a stunt double because the wig.
Probably is a man. So it's a very bad. Noticeable
so
stunt
bad.
Double.
So bad. Andrus Jones, in addition to
Attic Expeditions.
Attic Expeditions. Was also in Far From Home with Drew Barrymore.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. But what I know him best from, a film that Linnea Quigley is also in, and this is another movie that I rented so much back when I lived at home with my parents, and they would not pay attention to the things I was whacking off to. Sorority Babes in the Slime Ball Bowl-a-Rama. Terrific movie.
I just, until you said it, I just forgot that that existed, but I did rent that as well from, I believe it was Time Out Video in Morristown. Or maybe Video West. Either way, you kids don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. But I forgot that was one of my, that and Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers would always go into my rotation.
Oh man,
crazy movies.
Linnea Quigley is also
Linnea
in that.
Quigley
with
is
Gunner,
definitely
with Gunner
in that.
Gunner
Hansen.
And I want to give a direct shout out to Haunted Garage lead singer. He has a small role in that film. A gentleman by the name of Dookie Flyswatter.
Fucking amazing name.
Best name in Hollywood ever. Dookie Flyswatter, our good friend Brent, who, unfortunately.
We love you, Brent.
We love you, Brent. He has a life that is, not able to, afford him the opportunity to hang out with us very often. But we were watching Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers, and we were looking at the cast listing. We see Dookie Flyswatter. So we instantly became fans of this guy.
Absolutely. You have to.
I sent him a message on Facebook, and I'm like, hey, friend of mine's a big fan of yours. And this is, Cameron, who's been on the podcast in the past. I was like, he's a big fan. It'd be awesome if you could send him an autograph. Well, God, I mean, like, months go by, and I don't hear anything from him. I get something in the mail, and it's a fucking autograph set list from his band Haunted Garage. So it was one of the greatest...
Fuck yeah!
Like out-of-nowhere thrills. Like, wow, thank you for sending this to me to give to somebody else. Because I got to be, like, the hero for a day.
To bring this back to the movie, we're almost to arguably... One of the best, absolute best kills, definitely the ickiest, and probably most makeup involved in the whole series.
Yes, the cockroach death of Debbie, who we've already established earlier in the film, who is terrified
of cockroaches.
That effect, which we'll get to eventually.
Actually, I'm sorry, I'm rushing ahead.
Yeah,
for all those at home, I'm going to put a cigarette on my arm later. We love you.
But
still is a great scene coming, like the dream sequence.
Well, yes, this dream sequence is terrific as well.
Made me scared of movie theaters with balconies.
They don't really see these very often. I know they have a lot of metroplexes in like out west where they have like the balcony is where like you can drink beer and you know, have like little tables and you can eat and stuff. That's like a thing out that way.
I'm moving people. I love you, Sarah. Pack your bags.
It's slowly moving out this way, but movie theaters are turning more into almost like this social gathering kind of place where you eat a meal. A lot of them even have places where you can drop your kids off and they have ball pits and jungle gyms and that kind of stuff. So it's just like, you know, full
if your kid doesn't want to see a hard R movie for some weird reason, you can dump them off and be a good parent.
Do you think kids are coddled now when it comes to cinema? Because
you know what, I know this is my thing. I have a 4-year-old great nephew, and unfortunately, I did have to censor. He wanted to watch Halloween 6. I have that.
I hope it was the producer's cut.
It was not the producer's cut.
God damn it.
That's another reason I said no. But, you know, kids are coddled. Me, my parents never really coddled. They protected more against sex and violence. I remember that Silver Bullet was the first R-rated movie I ever saw. I was probably four. I was probably his age. Not a scary movie. Loved it. Loved the wheelchair. But kids these days are coddled, but then again, sometimes with the cooler parents, kids these days are kind of living in the golden age of horror movies.
That's true. And I just feel like we're in a position now where like everything is scrutinized to a point where like you can't even have fun with movies anymore.
You can't. And there's the weird balance. You can't, and everything's scrutinized. And at the same time, kids on their phone can watch whatever you want.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm sure kids today are probably exposed to far worse things than we ever were.
Listen,
in such a casual sense of the word, that like that even if they see like a movie, it probably wouldn't even bother them. It
would not even bother them at all.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right.
You hipster helicopter parents, I believe you should lock your children in a closet, make them watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, and if they come out unscarred, then they can do whatever they want and you no longer have a say. If they come out holding themselves, crying, then you've obviously done a bad thing and you should go to prison. You know, take that risk. Make good children.
Yeah, the first movie I ever can remember seeing in the theater was Pumpkinhead. And, I mean, it fucked me up for a long time. But obviously, like, I've turned out okay.
You've turned out amazing. The first theater movie I remember, and I barely remember the movie. I just remember I was so little I was afraid the seat would pop up and fall out the back. Was Return of the Jedi, and no, I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, sorry, to this point. I appreciate them. They're okay. But that was the first movie I saw in theaters. I was a little toddler. It was at the theater that was in downtown Morristown that closed.
I know which one you're talking about. Yeah. That was actually on Main Street?
Yes, it was on Main Street Firefox.
Do you know they had the premiere of Evil Dead in that theater?
I remember a helicopter. I remember hearing about that. I thought it was actually at the Capri, wasn't it?
No, it was downtown, on Main Street.
Well, my father, God rest his soul, was prone to exaggeration, but he talked about that when he saw I actually rented Evil Dead, not knowing it was filmed in Morristown one day, and he told me a little story. But he didn't go see it or anything. He just knew there was a big buzz around town.
This pizza we're seeing on screen, the
soul food,
the disgusting soul pizza of souls, which was it was created by John Carl Beekler. Also, the old age makeup that you saw Alice right before this was done by John Beekler as well. However, the scene we're about to see, arguably number one greatest Freddy Krueger kill. The only one I can think that even probably rivals it is the scene with Tina in the original where he drags her across the ceiling, just because you've never seen anything like that
for
in a
shocking
horror film.
And impactful and scary. It goes to Tina for creative, weird, viscerally upsetting when her elbows crack open. That genuinely, to this day, I still get like a little, ooh, God, that must have been, at the very least, I'm a very jaded horror movie watcher. At the very least, I still think, man, I bet that was gross to clean up. And that says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like straight hot ejaculate flesh pouring from her orifices.
Yes, and, you know, that is probably Freddy's most creative, like, it's definitely the most creative. It's the most roundabout backwards kill. Yeah, he's stabbed, he's burnt, he's hung, he's clawed, he's taken over a motor. You could argue the motorcycle in 5 was as imaginative but not as well done. It had to be heavily edited.
That scene is terrific. However, even to this day on DVD and on Blu-ray, it's edited. However, the VHS
showed the
is I unrated. I don't know how we've ended up in a position where we still don't have an unrated cut of a movie that is, every bit of the footage is available. It's just, it's ridiculous. Screaming Mad George, who is a titan of this era of film, worked on tons of things. He's the one behind the scene we're getting ready to see, the cockroach death.
Like he's up there with like a, and again, I'm blanky. Tom Savini.
Yeah, Greg Nicotero.
Greg Nicotero.
Howard Berger, who also worked on this film.
They brought in the big guns with 3, 4, and 5. Especially even 4 and 5 really they knew what they could lack in story, they needed to make up for in visuals, and they delivered on that. No matter what you feel about anything else in the movies,
if you say
it was, oh, that right there, just still to this day.
Now, the way they achieve this effect, they have the platform, like the bench that she's laying on. Until this shot, when she sits up
and it flops out, that's actually worse to me.
But she's sitting under there, and it took them like 4 or 5 hours to shoot this scene. And it took so long so that she was under there and she's like, hey, I gotta pee. And I don't know if she's 100% serious or if this actually happened, but she quips in the documentary that we mentioned earlier about the history of the and the making of these long-running slasher series, that they gave her a styrofoam cup and told her to go in. She's like, oh, I don't have a dick, so this is not going to work. So finally they got the shot. She got to go piss, and everything was fine and dandy. But it really makes you appreciate, like, the effort that goes into special effects. And it's not something you can just do. It takes time and effort. It really is an art form. And unfortunately, it's becoming more and more of a forgotten art form.
Well, that's why certain movies that have come out here recently that some people might disagree with, like the remake to Evil Dead, using all practical effects. I'm saying this because he refuses.
I will not watch it.
That's okay. Well, you know, that's why you do appreciate it more. That's why there are 4 Hatchet movies, even though the 4th one's Victor Crowley. You know, there is still an audience out there that loves and appreciates this kind of cinema. And there is no quicker way to make me hate a movie than digital gore. I mean, if you enhance, if you cover up the
CGI blood is so bad.
This is totally off topic, but I did not know this until recently that the sequel to The Thing was shot with practical effects.
Original effects, and then they CGI'd over them.
Yeah.
Have you seen the raw footage?
I have not seen the raw footage. I only found this out like...
Drop everything. Go on YouTube and type in The Thing 2011 or whenever was it that came out. Raw footage. Those effects are really good. I mean, they're not on par with like Rob Bottin's from 82, but I mean, for a movie made, you know, in the millennium, I mean, they were tremendous. And I don't understand why they thought, oh, fuck, well, we got a CGI over all this work we already did.
Exactly.
They ruined, I mean, let's just be honest, that movie was never going to live up to
I've never been able to finish it. No, it never was. I've tried to watch that movie on 3 separate occasions. One time I even made it about 1.5 hours in, and then somebody like called, and I'm like, well, just screw this movie. I'll take the call. I'm going to go get something to eat. I've never finished it.
Well, you're not missing
anything. I'm not missing anything. I know.
All right. It was in one out ear. One in, one out. I can't even talk. I'm
in
so
one eye,
off.
Out the ears. You know, it's just a forgettable movie.
Fuck it.
Unlike Nightmare on Elm Street 4, very memorable. No matter how you feel about it, you can close your eyes right now if you are a Freddy fan and go scene by scene and watch these movies over and over in your head if you're crazy. We love you.
We just saw the crash of Alice and Dan. I guess this would be a good talk.
Poor Dan. Let's give him some love.
Let's give him some love. Oddly enough, Dan is played by Danny Hassel. And because the script was always in flux because of the writer's strike, they ended up just naming the character Dan because it was just simpler because of they cast him.
Absolutely.
And he quips on multiple occasions that he thought he was doing such a bad job that they named the character Dan because they thought he was so bad that they needed to name him that for him to remember his lines or whatever. But no, he's fine, and he reprises his role in Part 5 as well.
Has the best death scene in Part 5.
Absolutely. Definitely the one that comes to mind.
It's the only one, really, of note. I mean, there's great effects and a great effects team behind all the deaths in Part 5, but he's the only one that's just, yeah, fuck yeah.
I mean, like, Part 5 has all of the great visuals, but yeah, the deaths no are blood. A little
The director
killing.
Hates the sight of blood.
Well.
I remember hearing that.
He can suck a dog's dick for all I care.
Red Rocket, motherfucker.
Danny had some small roles. He did Murder, She Wrote, which is another...
I've seen that from...
They all worked on Murder, She Wrote, just like the X-Files. The same casting director, for whatever reason. They all ended up working on the same films. He also worked on Simon and Simon and Columbo.
Just one more thing. Sorry, but I had my mother, grandmother, aunt. They all loved those old murder mysteries in the day, and yet gave me a hard time about enjoying horror fiction. Monsters.
Like the show Monsters?
No, I love that show, though. And I thought I had a fever dream when I was a child about that show existing until the channel, I believe it's defunct, Chiller, would air daytime marathons of Monster, and they used to have VHS copies at a place in Morristown. I really thought I imagined or had a dream of that show when it actually aired. The Chiller, rest in peace.
Oh, we have Shudder now. Which
Shudder's
is,
much better. Yes. I'd much rather have Shudder, but Chiller led the way for Shudder.
It was
they
good.
Would have daytime marathons of either Monsters or Freddy's Nightmares, and there was a third. Oh, Friday the 13th. And that's the only time I ever watched it. Their movies were so heavily edited, it wasn't worth it. But
at that point, like. Especially if it was a movie you already own. And if you take a look to the left of this room, I own quite a few.
I did see The Girl Next Door. I didn't know they had made a movie of that because that book is so disturbing.
Jack Ketchum's
Girl Next Door. I did see that on there. Heavily edited, but still very effective movie. One of the most disturbing books I've ever read. Jack Ketchum is awesome.
That it is. That's actually a pretty decent adaptation of that book. If you actually get to see it, like
oh,
the
absolutely.
I've since watched it. I know we kind of glossed over a little bit, but Debbie, the played by Brooke Thies, the cockroach arm.
We love you and your big hair.
She's done quite a few things as well. She was in a few episodes of Growing Pains with Kirk Cameron.
Boom.
Crazy Kirk Cameron. She was in 47 episodes of Just the 10 of Us with Nightmare on Elm Street alumni, Heather Langenkamp, a.k.a. Nancy. So that's kind of a cool full circle connection with the two of them. She also in that show was Joanne Willett. She has a small role in Nightmare 2. So it's a weird crossover. I know I keep saying that, but there's always weird interconnected things.
Well, a lot of people get their start in horror movies. You know, that's where... casting directors are probably willing to take the most risk because it's a horror movie. Let's pump them out.
Yeah.
And then they get a credit, you know, then they get the small roles elsewhere and, you know, then they all end up on X-Files.
That's your show. One or another. She was on 13 episodes of the show Home Free.
Don't remember that at all.
Well, the only reason I bring this up is it was the show that Matthew Perry was on before he got cast in Friends. So it's retroactively become sort of popular, but at the time it was like nobody cared about it. She was in 9 episodes of Beverly Hills 90210, and she was in the Halle Berry starring Catwoman shitfest.
I'm proud to say, unlike Brandon's refusing to watch Evil Dead, I have always refused to watch Catwoman, and I maintain that my choice is correct. If y'all agree with me, comment or something, send us an email that Anthony is correct in ignoring Catwoman, but let's see if we can get a lot of heat on him to do an episode about the remake of Evil Dead.
We'll see
what it takes.
Listen, Catwoman is pretty fucking bad, and as much shit as we give the DCEU right now, it could be so much worse, because I'll take the worst DCEU movie over that fucking Catwoman movie. It's unwatchable.
I only needed the previews to let me know, don't go see this. And it came out of an era when I did not pay to go to the theater. I could have seen it for free, and I'm still, no.
Yeah, that's saying something. I mean, we're both frugal individuals. We selectively spend our money. We'll splurge on the things that we love, but we're not going to throw our money at something.
No.
That, you know, so free always goes a long way with either one of us.
I saw so many movies back in the day. I remember seeing Surf Ninjas twice.
It was Leslie Nielsen and Rob Schneider.
I had nothing else to do that day. I went and saw it twice.
Oh my God. Man, those were the days of terrible movies. Which surf movie do you prefer? Surf Nazis Must Die or Surf Ninjas?
Surf Nazis Must Die. I honestly, genuinely, that's one of my favorite trauma.
But do you know why you love Surf Nazis Must Die, even though if you realize it or not? Because Dookie Flyswatter is in it.
Now that I know, I want to get a chest piece tattoo of that man, because that's really cool. Just sending.
Do you know what he looks like?
I have no idea. Who is he in the movie?
Oh,
is
man.
He a character with lines?
He is a character with lines. He's one of the main Nazis.
That's awesome.
Man, Dookie, if you happen to hear this, his real name is Michael Sonye. He's really cool to his fans, but he is an unfortunate looking fellow. So I want to just go ahead and knock that out.
You're probably better looking than me, buddy.
Let's do some quick general trivia.
Then, yeah, because we're getting close to the end.
We're getting close to the end.
Most nonsensical, but visually stunning endings to any 80s horror movie ever.
I will say this, from a visual standpoint, this ending is awesome. However, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is the only one that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. All the movies are kind of, their endings, we've had this conversation, people, in the past. The endings of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies never really, you can kind of see one, you can kind of see three. I don't see Freddy being beaten by the power of love into seeing his reflection in this one.
Yeah.
And then the fetus soul turning on him.
Yeah, but that makes a little sense,
but this is, hey, here's your reflection, all these mirrors that you put in the dreams because you make the settings, still having mirrors being somehow your weakness.
Yeah.
But it looks amazing.
Well, This whole scene, in our interview with Mick Strawn, he talks about how they created this whole area, and without going into detail, because you've already heard, a little black fabric and a smoke machine goes a long way, so Mick Strawn is the man. All right, we went over this earlier. Nightmare 4 was the highest grossing of the series till Freddy vs. Jason. This is the first film in the series where Robert Englund received top billing.
As is due.
He absolutely deserved it. I would argue that by the third movie, he should have gotten it.
Absolutely.
The success of this movie directly led to Freddy's Nightmares. I mentioned that before. According to Annette Benson, who was the casting director, over 600 actresses auditioned for the role of Alice, including Ellie Cornell, who ended up with the role of Rachel in Halloween 4. They built a giant Freddy torso for a scene we're going to see here in just a moment. Steve Johnson, effects artist, designed that. And they got a little overzealous when directing this scene, because they're like, yeah, Rand, Linnea, really push your tits out there, really get it. And the fucking thing tips over.
Oh my God.
They were lucky these people didn't walk out like, I mean, just fucking bruised, broken, beaten, and scarred. It's not in service anymore, but Freddy was so popular at the time, he had his own 900 number.
Which, I was at a friend's house, who will remain unnamed, because we denied this forever. After church one Saturday, I was raised Seventh-day Adventist, and we snuck and called it, stayed about 2 minutes, like, oh God, we're not that we were scared of the phone, like, we just knew we were going to get our asses beat, so we hung up very quickly.
I want to give a quick rundown on Mick Strawn, because he was nice enough to give us an interview. As a production designer, he worked on The Hidden with Kyle MacLachlan, which is
a terrific movie.
22 episodes of Freddy's Nightmares, where he had the budget of a penny, and he stretched it all day long.
They all look good.
He worked on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, which is a super underrated sequel. Frankenstein the College Years, one of my favorite movies that has never been released on DVD.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Terrific.
Does he play football in that movie?
He does.
Oh my God.
It's Encino, yes. It's Encino Man, but with Frankenstein's monster. It's a terrific movie. He was in Strays, which is a movie about cat people.
That, yeah.
Revenge of the Nerds 3. He also did the unreleased Roger Corman produced Fantastic Four movie, which he and I have a long discussion about that, which is the best Fantastic Four movie. And unfortunately, very few people have seen it. Not that it's a great movie, but it's the most
tricky. When you look at what it's got.
And he's doing the upcoming film Vengeance, which is a direct sequel to Friday the 13th Part 6, which was 100% fan-funded. I am a backer of that film, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
Asking about that, is this by any chance from the guys that did Never Walk Alone? Or
Never Hike Alone?
Never Hike Alone.
Some of the same people are involved with
really
it.
Really enjoyed that. Like Brandon put me onto that.
I got the Blu-ray copy film up here on the shelf. It's a terrific. It's actually, for my money, it's the best horror fan film ever made.
We're seeing
the people busting out of the chest of souls. And where's her fucking titties at?
They're coming. The miniature work was done really well, too.
There we go.
We love you.
Yeah, Linnea, you're always...
Nightmare Sisters on Facebook.
You're my forever love.
Greasy Strangler.
Greasy Strangler, I'm glad you got that reference. I literally just watched that again the night before last.
Great movie.
Terrific movie. All right, we'll plow through these pretty quick. From Kevin Corville, which kill would you consider the most unique of the series?
We answered that. Cockroach.
Cockroach kill. A unique sense. I mean, it's unbeatable. Why didn't Patricia Arquette come back? I know in the Never Sleep Again documentary, Bob Shea mentions her agent got smart and wanted more money, but what do you think is the reason?
I believe it's just that. You know, she was going back. I'm very sorry.
How dare you?
Brandon leaves his phone on, and I left my alarm for my lovely fiance still on, which that reminds me, I'm going to turn off the other one. I do believe it was that, you know, she wanted more money probably and deservedly, and she was coming back to play a character who gets killed. You know, by that time, Patricia Arquette probably getting a bigger name. I'm not really from, I know Patricia Arquette, but I don't know the chronology of her filmography.
Well, I mean, she did some bigger roles, but there was a gap there. She was available to do this movie by all accounts. According to the actor who played Joey, in discussions he had with her, it all came down to money. And Bob Shea is notorious for...
He's a cheapskate.
So they could have had her, but they opted to get an up-and-comer rather than bring back somebody who...
We love you Tuesday night.
We do love you Tuesday night, and I would very much like to enter your vagine.
I want to watch.
All right. This comes from Jason Davis. He's our tech support guy here at the podcast, so... Admittedly, I'm not as familiar with Freddy as opposed to other slashers, but I've always been confused by why he went after teens and young adults rather than children, because his backstory involved him killing kids. What's up with that?
The MPAA.
Well, that's one reason to look at it. But he went after the surviving kids of Elm Street to get revenge on the parents who murdered him. There's actually a deleted scene in the original Nightmare on Elm Street where Nancy's mother is telling her that I can't remember if she had a brother or a sister, but she had a sibling that Freddie had murdered, and that's why they were so adamant about, you know, getting justice outside of the system, because they didn't sign the warrant and all that stuff, and he got released on a technicality.
And to follow the logic of the movies, he gets the other souls from Alice, who associates with teenagers, doesn't know a lot of kids, so, you know, he's using her mind to pull them in. You know, there's not going to be kids.
That's true. She's the dream master. Read the fucking what it says on the cover.
Read it, damn it. And then, but then you see in Freddy vs. Jason the real disturbing, like, flashback. They show him killing. They don't show the kills, but they show him with kids. Probably he'd prefer something younger. That's gross.
Okay, I mean, all right. There's a big hard line of people that agree or disagree that Freddy was a child molester. It's never expressly said, but Wes Craven always intended Freddy Krueger was a child molester and killer.
That's one reason that I really did enjoy the remake with Jackie Earle Haley. It's kind of the same reasons I enjoyed part two. It's nasty. If they would have went one step further with the kitty diddling instead of kitty murder, it's just straight kitty diddling in that movie, I probably would have left. If not left, I'd have been pissed at the movie. It did it just enough to make me squirm and be just nasty and just to really put me in an uncomfortable spot, especially when they find the Polaroid. Jackie Earle Haley, which that's not his only chomo role either.
Yes, Little Children.
Little Children, very disturbing.
He won an Academy Award for that.
And he deserved it too, but... And you saw what happened with that movie and the reception of that movie. Because people are wrong and it's a good movie.
All right. These last three questions are from a gentleman we've had on the podcast before, known as Titty Flippin' Travis. So we'll flash through these and we'll call it a night. Does Freddy have a functional penis?
Absolutely.
Or does it look like a wiener left on a grill too long and forever extra crispy?
It's functional, girthy, and not too long. Little curve to hit the G spot.
Well, obviously it's functional. He gets Alice pregnant.
Yeah.
So now there's your answer right there. If in your dreams, does Freddy have a crispy critter or a hot, hefty hog?
Hot, hefty hog.
I don't know what the fuck the difference is. Whichever is funnier, whichever is the grosser, that's my answer.
Exactly.
You sick fuck. And one last question. And I have an extended answer for this, and we'll call it a night. How many wet dreams have you had, and has Freddy appeared in any of them?
I have a quick answer for that. I have actually, to my memory, had two. And no, Freddy did not show up in either one of them. But weirdly enough, in the first one, it was my church school teacher that was in it.
Now, that's kinky.
I won't say her name because she was a good woman, but she was overseeing the proceedings in my dream.
She was a Dorothy on the streets and Blanche on the sheets.
Yes, she was
Golden Girls reference. Do you remember the Josh Hartnett movie? I can't think of what it's called, but the whole thing is he gave up sex.
40 days and 40 nights.
Yes. All right, when that movie came out, I was like, well, fuck, it can't be that hard to go this long without...
If I got 3 days, I'll kill someone.
...sex or yanking it. And let's just put it this way. After about 2 weeks, I woke up with enough cum in my bed to drown a toddler.
I stopped by while he's sleeping.
That was an awkward moment. I was still living with my parents at the time, so those sheets got yanked up pretty quick and thrown into the washer because I did not want to have that conversation with what had happened.
Well, real talk, the second time I had, we are still in credits, so we're still in movie mode. I wasn't joking when I said done a little prison time. Apparently, my cutoff is 31 days. And then in the middle of a hallway in Hamblen County Prison, wake up with the biggest wet spot ever. And apparently you think, oh God, I'm going to get made fun of. Oh God, I'm going to have to kill somebody. No, they're like, no, dude, just go jack off in the shower more, man. No, it happens. Very understanding people in county jail about wet dreams.
Well, and on that note, I think it's about time we say good night.
And pleasant dreams.
And pleasant dreams. But one final thing, please follow us on Twitter at Rance Black Lodge and subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, Radio, Google Play Music, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, and of course, track us down on our homepage at JuicyKruger.com. For Fat Tony, this is Brandon A. Lane saying pleasant screams.